For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be spending this part of WGTD's morning show talking about a struggle that has played out all across the country in communities of all kinds of different sizes, and that is the struggle to help downtowns to maintain their vibrancy or to rebuild after falling into steep decline. It's a story that's played out again and again, as I just said, and it is examined in really fascinating fashion in a new book called The Heart of the City, Creating Vibrant Downtowns for a New Century. The author of the book is Alexander Garvin, who has held a number of different important administrative posts with New York City. He has written a number of different books. He is adjunct professor at the Yale School of Architecture and president and CEO of AGA Public Realm Strategists. And he has examined this this complicated issue from a lot of different angles. And I found myself learning a tremendous amount from reading his book, which is published by Island Press, again titled The Heart of the City, Creating Vibrant Downtowns for a New Century. Alexander Garvin, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's my pleasure, and thanks for the kind words about the book.
I want to make sure to get one thing out of the way, and that is the fact that your book really focuses on the downtowns of America's major cities. And so that is what you are talking about. But of course, it isn't just the major cities of America that have been confronted with this conundrum of how to maintain vibrant downtowns. For much smaller cities, this is an issue. And for small towns, for that matter, the vitality of downtown is often an issue of central concern. I'm just curious if there is significant applicability in what your book talks about to any of these other settings, that is, smaller cities or much smaller communities that also want their downtowns to be healthy.
I write about Cincinnati and New Haven, both of which are rather small downtowns, and the cities themselves are quite small. It's not just Los Angeles and Chicago. It's small cities as well, and I write about every size from New Haven up to Los Angeles.
Right. I guess what I'm asking, though, is for a city that is, for instance, 50,000, I mean, that's significantly smaller than Cincinnati, or for that matter, for a town of 10,000, are those completely different scenarios, or are some of the lessons learned from these bigger places applicable in those situations as well?
There are lessons that can be learned. First of all, most downtowns began as small downtowns of a few thousand people and a small number of businesses, so they grew. And in some cases, they never stopped growing. They didn't have a decline. Houston has been growing steadily. It's soon going to displace Chicago as the third largest city in the United States. Many of its sections were totally undeveloped 80 years ago. I write about the three downtowns in Houston, one of which is called Uptown. It is today the 17th largest downtown in the United States. In 1950, it was undeveloped agricultural land. So, yes, there is a lesson. And the lesson that the book presents is that in order to thrive, these cities needed to have high-density, mixed-use downtowns. If they were simply business districts, they went to sleep at 6 o'clock on Friday afternoons and awakened again at 6 o'clock in the morning on Monday. And that's why so many of them were dying in the 1950s. It wasn't only that people were moving to the suburbs and the businesses following them because that was the labor force and the shopping facilities following them because they were the market to be attracted. It was also that they were not exciting places for people to be. That has all changed. And the turnaround roughly began around 1990. Mm. There are three trajectories that I put forward. One, the Houstons and Dallases that never stop growing. Secondly, there's a set of downtowns that have been struggling for over half a century, like Detroit, St. Louis, Bridgeport. They have not come out of the funk. And then there are the remarkable resurgent downtowns, everything from New Haven, for that matter, all the way to Lower Manhattan, which for most of my lifetime was a dying downtown. It turned around after 9/11, and not because of the terrorist attack, but rather because of a change in the economy. Hmm. And the change was very, very simple. The internet appeared. And the internet made it unnecessary for people to have filing cabinets, filing clerks. The amount of space we use in a typical business went from 500 square feet per worker in 1970 to 150 today. So people who were in obsolete, older office buildings moved into the newly built, well-supplied with internet and other modern features, new buildings. The old buildings emptied out, and developers purchased them and converted them to residents and hotels. And so you have Lower Manhattan, for example, going from a downtown population of around 800 in 1970 to today in excess of 60,000. And the same thing in downtown Los Angeles and even in downtown New Haven, where you can see new apartment buildings being built.
Hmm. I appreciated that actually your book tells all of us something that I think most of us don't know, namely where the term downtown originated. And it actually originated in New York City. Explain the origins of the term and also, in a sense, what we need to think now of in terms of a proper definition of downtown.
Those are excellent questions. The downtown that we knew in Lower Manhattan in 1800 was a concentration of mixed uses at a fairly high density. And as the city of New York grew, it spread northward. And what moved northward was the residential population. Eventually, when we had buses and mass transit, it spread even further. And people in the first part of the 19th century who were living north of the center of the city started saying they were going downtown because they were north of the downtown. And this became something that was picked up in other cities like Boston and Philadelphia that were growing at the same time. In terms of a definition, I think there are many things that have to be there. First of all, the downtown is the incubator of knowledge and culture. It's got to be a place where people go, not just to the library or to the university or to a hospital, but also where they can see a show, go to a museum, go for a walk. It's got to have places that people want to be. And those are not just businesses or apartments. They have to be places people want to go. The second thing I would say is that these downtowns are the incubators of innovation, of new businesses. That's where things get started. And therefore, it's a very important part of the city. For example, downtown Philadelphia is about 6% of the territory of the entire city, and it produces 44% of the jobs. That's an extraordinary number. And the same thing would be true in any downtown. That's where things that matter to the economy of the city and where jobs appear and where life continues after 6 o'clock in the afternoon.
I think one matter that we haven't yet touched on is more geographical in nature versus what happens in a downtown. The question of where is downtown and the fact that at least in almost in just about every case, we're talking about downtown having kind of a centrality to a city. I mean, because
well,
those
I
things...
I would dispute that. I have several drawings in the book of downtowns in Dallas and Atlanta. There are three downtowns in Atlanta. There weren't three downtowns 50 years ago, but there are now. The same thing is true in Houston, and certainly true in New York. We've just recently developed a brand new downtown called Long Island City, which is where Amazon wanted to move because it was such an attractive downtown. It's growing in front of your eyes, and we have well over half a dozen such downtowns. There isn't just a central downtown.
So we need to really rethink the notion of downtown, because what I just trotted out is, in a sense, at least in your view, an outmoded notion of what downtown is, because I think most of us tend to think of downtown and then the suburbs that tend to draw people and energy away from downtown. And you're saying that a downtown, in a sense, can spring up just about anywhere.
Well, it has to, in your words, it has to be central to the people that use it. I think your observation is right on target. And you can see these downtowns evolving. Boston, for example, has a whole new section called the Seaport. That's where there's a new convention center, hotels, new businesses, the federal court, a redevised downtown park. It's not in the Back Bay, and it's not where City Hall is. It's a different downtown. And the centrality is very important, but it's central to the people who use it. And without paying attention to who uses the downtown, you can't truly understand what it is.
We're speaking with Alexander Garvin about his book, The Heart of the City, Creating Vibrant Downtowns for a New Century. One of the things that is especially fun about your book is reading about all of the success stories, and you've already touched on quite a number of them. I mean, either downtowns that have remained consistently vibrant or other downtowns that have managed to achieve spectacular resurgent for a number of different reasons. Let's talk for a moment about a couple of the major cities that have not yet tasted that success. Detroit, for one, a city I've barely seen. St. Louis, for another. That's a city I visited a number of times, and I have been struck by the fact that its downtown is quite lifeless, especially compared to so much of the vibrancy that we maybe see in other places in and around St. Louis. But its downtown is not what anybody really wants it to be. Can we point to any particular factors that have kept those cities from achieving more success with their downtowns?
In each case, there are different reasons. If you take St. Louis, which you were mentioning, St. Louis went through a series of efforts to try and revive the downtown. And they were large-scale projects, each of them far enough away from the other that people would drive there, go to the attraction, get back in their car, and drive away. So you have Union Station, which is a shopping facility. You have the baseball park. Well, they're about a mile apart. You have the government center. You have the Arch. The Arch is sitting in the middle of nowhere on the other side of the highway, in between the Mississippi River and the highway. You go there, you don't go anywhere else because it's too far away. So that's its problem. Detroit is completely different. Detroit lost a huge portion of its market. In 1950, the population was nearly 1,900,000 people. Today, it's under 800,000. When you lose that many people, you lose the workers who travel downtown, and you lose the customers. Detroit had the second largest department store in the world, Hudson's. Today, it has no department stores. It has a residential population of 5,000 people. The residential population of Buckhead, which is the third downtown in Atlanta, has 12,500 people, and they have 10 department stores because it services the surrounding population, which has been growing, whereas the population of metropolitan Detroit has been moving away into the suburbs or disappearing.
One of the most important chapters in your book, I think, is one called Lessons for Any Downtown, which, among other things, kind of shoots down what have been proposed as maybe relatively easy, simple answers to the quandary of how to help our downtowns thrive. And a couple of them, I think, are particularly interesting. One you call the mirage of urban redevelopment, and the other involves the matter of transportation, that what you need to do is make it easier to get in and out of downtown, and suddenly you'll have people flocking to the downtown in increasing numbers. And both of those need to be carefully reexamined. Let's speak with the first about the mirage of urban redevelopment. On the surface, it sounds like something that makes a whole lot of sense. How has this been misunderstood or misapplied?
In many places, my prime example would be Hartford, Connecticut. The idea was that the downtown was obsolete. It didn't work. It needed to be changed functionally, and it needed to be made accessible by motor vehicle, both automobiles and trucks and buses. And so they built a platform, stuck the cars underneath the platform. The platform, Constitution Plaza, it's called, was set apart from the rest of downtown. So people went there, got out of their cars, went upstairs, and they never set foot in the rest of the downtown. Eventually, it turned out Constitution Plaza wasn't a great help. And we have such urban redevelopment projects in many cities which failed to work. In New Haven, Connecticut, for example, the downtown included an air-conditioned shopping mall. The air-conditioned shopping mall was supposed to be accessible by interstate highway, which was being built. But instead, people got on the highway and went home to the suburbs, and they would stop in the shopping mall in the suburbs on their way home. And they didn't go to the shopping mall in downtown New Haven. And the two department stores there closed one after another, including Macy's. So you have to be very careful as to how you rebuild. There are places where, in fact, there is a lack of functioning. I would argue that the most important thing is to make it easily accessible. And not to do this only with highways, because the highways gave the ability to the people who work downtown to leave just as much as it did for the trucks coming in bringing goods. So it's a mirage, as I say.
Right. And it, in some ways, it's one of the saddest things to consider, something that probably for a given city might seem like the golden key or the magic bullet that's going to make everything better, and in some cases it has not led to that success at all, and probably in certain cases at considerable expense, a very
yes.
expensive lesson.
Absolutely.
I think one of the important things you talk about in terms of the success stories are certain cities in which they have found a way to, in a sense, brand themselves. That is, they, I think in your words, have managed to create a distinctive image. And among the success stories in this regard that you talk about is a vibrant downtown not far from us, Chicago, Illinois. Explain, for instance, what Chicago has managed to do in terms of crafting a distinctive image for its downtown.
Well, it began more than a century ago with the plan of Chicago of 1909, which proposed to redo the waterfront. The waterfront was then filled with railroad tracks and garbage. Today, there are 23 miles of park, including spectacular beaches, and all the most expensive residences and the most expensive office buildings face Lake Michigan and this continuous belt of parkland. The most recent addition to it is Millennial Park, which added a concert venue on top of everything else. So it doesn't have to be some special structure. It may be to create a unique character, which is the shoreline of Lake Michigan. I talk about Uptown Houston, which is the second of three downtowns in Houston, and it has most extraordinary stainless steel arches going across its main street, Post Oak Boulevard, which gives it an image unlike any downtown street that I know in the country. So there are many ways you can do this. My favorite of all of the attempts combines mass transit access and a pedestrian realm with that, and that is downtown Denver. Downtown Denver, 40 years ago, pedestrianized its main street, 16th Street, and it was lovely, and it attracted new investment along it. But it wasn't really as central as it needed to be. The city and the surrounding suburban counties at the beginning of the 21st century voted a 0.4 cent sales tax to pay for a light rail system. So they have a series of diagonal light rail lines that come in from all directions of the suburb and from the airport. And they bring you downtown to 16th Street. And on 16th Street, there is a free bus. At every 90 seconds, it stops. So you can drive to your garage, get out, get on the free bus, go to the office. At lunchtime, go down from your office to 16th Street, get on the bus, and go to a place for lunch. That's unique in the country. And then at the end of the day, get back on the light rail system and go to your suburban house.
Hmm. When a city is confronting the challenge of trying to revitalize its downtown, in many, many cases, they face a problem that you talk about and characterize as the chicken and the egg. You write, the relationship between the actual number of residents in an area and the number needed to support necessary services is a chicken and egg proposition. A critical mass of residents is needed to support retail services, and a critical mass of children is needed to justify opening and operating a school. But how does one get both of those things to happen? What is your solution for that eternal quandary of the chicken and the egg?
Well, it's an extremely difficult thing to do. I can't tell you that there's a formula, but I can point out that we've had a number of warehouse districts in downtowns. We have that in Minneapolis. We have that in Cleveland. And those districts, when the warehouses were vacated, had no residents and no workers. And what began to happen is what started in New York City, in Soho, and that is artists began to move in, and various nonconformist residents who liked the notion of having large amounts of space at low prices. And once you get enough of them, they become a potential market, and you can virtually date the turnaround in the warehouse district in Minneapolis to when Whole Foods opens its facility there, or even in a section of Denver where they were building new buildings. You need to have enough people to support the services that they need, and it is very difficult to say which comes first, because if you don't have those facilities, nobody is going to move in, and once they're there, you begin to have a great deal of additional customers that are renting apartments and starting businesses there.
Right. I suppose it's a matter of certain developers having a sense of vision and a sense of faith and
you know,
willing to take a chance. And I suppose part of that is if they trust, for instance, the leaders of a city, that they will follow through in appropriate fashion to help make all of this happen, it can indeed happen. And there's nothing more satisfying than when one sees a struggling downtown enjoy this kind of resurgence. Well, I wonder if we could have you talk for just a moment before we finish about kind of an interesting experience you had in New York City, where you have worked most of your life. At certain points in time when it looked like New York City might go for being the site of the Olympic Games. And I only mention it because it sounds like, even though those were efforts that, you know, in a sense kind of ultimately came for naught, that a lot of good just came out of that situation or that scenario in which certain sort of in which certain entities were kind of forced to examine new possibilities, and some of those possibilities actually came to fruition.
I was responsible for making the plan to bring the Olympics to New York, and my client was Dan Dockeroff, who later became the deputy mayor under Michael Bloomberg. And during the time that I prepared the plan, I had to identify sites for all kinds of things that you needed at the Olympics, everything from an Olympic stadium to a major swimming pool. During the course of this, I looked at virtually 300 different substantially vacant sites around the city of New York, and we identified them and made the plan. One of the critical parts of this was the Hudson Yards. There were two rail yards behind Pennsylvania Station that had been sitting empty, anything on top of them, since Pennsylvania Station opened at the beginning of the 20th century. There had been numerous plans to redevelop it by different players going back into the 1920s. None of them worked. We needed an Olympic stadium. I thought a great place to put it was on those yards. We also needed to have a broadcast center and several other facilities and an Olympic Square, and I thought the Hudson Yards would be fine, along with 8 mat sports in the convention center, which was on the edge of the Hudson River. And one day I walked into Dockeroff's office, and I said, our plan doesn't work. And he said, why not? I said, I can't get the people I need to the convention center. we have to move 50,000 to 100,000 people to the stadium. They can't get there. Well, what do you do about it, he said. I said, extend the number 7 subway. And he said, well, how do we pay for it? And I said, I'll tell you next week. And I came in next week with 3 images. One was of Grand Central Terminal in 1902, the old one. The second, also taken from 46th Street looking south, with the new Grand Central Terminal that is there now. And there were bridges across the rail tracks for 45th Street, 46th Street. And then the third image was a drawing of all the buildings from St. Bartholomew's Church and the Waldorf Astoria south to the Yale Club and on 42nd Street that had been built on the rail yards. Dan got it instantly. The real estate taxes from those buildings could pay for the platforming. He became the deputy mayor. He and Michael Bloomberg decided they needed to extend the number 7 subway. We have done exactly that. The city guaranteed a bond issue to extend the subway. And the Hudson Yards is today half finished with thousands of square feet of new office space and new apartments. It's the newest thing without relocation, extending Midtown Manhattan towards the Hudson River. And also, by having that public access by transit, all kinds of parking lots and abandoned buildings that had been on the far west side are being rebuilt as new office buildings and new apartment houses. It's one of the great successes. The other places were all along the waterfront. We now have a Brooklyn Bridge Park, which had been identified for the Olympics. We have a number of these sites, all of which came about because Dockeroff was familiar with the sites we were going to use for the Olympics that could be reused for something else.
Mm. I just love that one situation, in a sense, almost inadvertently led to some wonderful breakthroughs and wonderful successes. That's just one of many intriguing real-life success stories woven into this very, very interesting book, again called The Heart of the City, Creating Vibrant Downtowns for a New Century, outlining many gratifying success stories across the country, as well as some, I should say, cautionary tales of cities that have attempted to make this happen and have fallen short and one hopes will find ways to try again. The book is published by Island Press, the author, Alexander Garvin. Alexander Garvin, I enjoyed our conversation, and I very much enjoyed your book. Thank you so much for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you for having me.
And the time is 8:42. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. To finish out today's morning show, I'm going to be replaying a conversation that I recorded in the spring of last year with best-selling author John Meacham. Our topic was his most recent book, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. It's a book in which John Meacham examines those points in American history when our country was most badly divided and discusses the ways in which America has managed again and again to rise above those divisions. I began the interview by asking John Meacham to compare the divided state of our country today with how our country was divided in 1861 on the eve of the Civil War.
It was the peroration at the just as the secession winter was coming along and the country was disintegrating. And one of the reasons my mind went to it is in any period of division and contention, which tends to be the rule rather than the exception in American life, we have to struggle to listen to those better angels. And they are there. Sometimes they seem awfully far away. But our best eras have been defined by those moments in which we have managed to more generously interpret the Jeffersonian idea of human equality, which was what Lincoln in the Maelstrom of War was trying to do.
Explain to our listeners what has prompted you to write this particular book. What about our current climate that served as sort of the most powerful galvanizing force for you to shape this narrative of our history in this way?
Well, two things. Really. There's the events in Charlottesville last August when the neo-Nazis and Klansmen marched in support of a Robert E. Lee statue and a young counter-protester was killed, and the president of the United States had a hard time figuring out which side he was on, was the immediate occasion. But more broadly, I get asked all the time, I'm sure you do, has it ever been this divided? Has it ever been so terrible? Well, yeah, Fort Sumter was pretty bad. The American Revolution itself was pretty bad in terms of Tories versus Patriots. The McCarthy era, the 1930s, 1968. If you and I had been talking 50 years ago today, 46 American servicemen died in Vietnam on an average of 46 a day, every day in 1968. So my argument is not relax, everything's going to be fine. It's let's figure out what happened in the past, learn from it, and work to make everything fine.
So in other words, everything becoming better is not an inevitability that we should just wait to happen. It's something...
No, Lord, no. I mean, the entire American story is one of difficult steps forward against extraordinary forces, often based on human appetite, ambition, a need, an understandable human impulse on the part of people who have power to keep that power. The reason the Constitution is as resilient as it is because it is a document that takes into account human frailty, human appetite, human ambition. As Madison said in Federalist 51, ambition must be made to counteract ambition. And so the system itself was designed for moments of unrest, for seasons of anger, for moments that felt as though everything was ending. And unquestionably, this is in many ways a unique time, but the underlying forces that produce this particular presidency, that produce this particular moment, are perennial ones in the American experience.
One of the key words in your book is that of fear. And it's interesting to think about fear, the potency that fear has as a force. And of course, when we are fearful for maybe misguided reasons or simplistic reasons, it's something that really undermines the common good. On the other hand, it's not that we shouldn't be fearful at all, that there aren't things that we should legitimately fear. How would you have us as a nation and each of us individually sort out this matter of fear and of what to be fearful?
I think there's a distinction between fear and concern, between anger and grievance, if you will. Fear is a disorienting emotional state. Concern is a rational assent to the idea that there is something that requires work, requires reform, requires preservation, whatever it is. Fear is a state that leads us to an anxiety that we're on the precipice, that things are going to fall apart. Edmund Burke wrote that there's nothing more, nothing creates more unreasoning than fear. And fear creates an atmosphere in which really we can overreach, we can do things that are not true to who we are at our best. Being concerned is a natural state of any human moment, actually, but certainly in the life of a republic. So, again, not saying that there's not plenty to worry about, but the great thing about the American Revolution, the great thing about the enduring American system, is that it created a space for reason to have a chance against passion in the arena. And I fear, I'm anxious right now that we are too often putting our chips on passion rather than reason.
When you look back at our history and some of these critical moments in which we were deeply divided and with the very real potential of being really torn asunder, you point in many cases to presidents who very much rose to the occasion and led the nation in a more positive, radiant direction. And in some cases, presidents who, in a sense, defied their own personal backgrounds, their own personal histories, mm-hmm. and in a sense, rose to the occasion in a way that probably perhaps even surprised themselves. Can you give one or two examples of what I'm talking about?
Well, the two most recent examples that are most vivid are Harry Truman and Lyndon Johnson on the question of civil rights and race. And Truman came from a border state. His family, part of his family, had been Confederates, quite sympathetic to the secessionist cause. And he used racial slurs in private to the end of his life. But when he became president in April 1945, he really decided that he had become the president of all the people, and that his obligation was to try to extend the protections of the Bill of Rights, the promise of the Constitution and the Declaration to all Americans, integrating the military and launching the first significant civil rights program. Roughly the same thing happened to Lyndon Johnson when he became vice president and then president in November 1963. Johnson had been a white Southern senator. He had not been a big fan of civil rights because of political reasons. And yet he decided in the wake of Dallas and the cataclysm of the assassination that he was going to pass John Kennedy's civil rights bill and not change a comma. And as people reflected on why was it that he was taking this great risk right before a national election in 1964, Johnson said, well, what the hell is the presidency for if not to do the big things that other men might not do?
I think your book is not just saying that we, because of good fortune or divine providence or whatever, just happen to have the right presidents at the right time to lead us out of some of our, or lead us through and out of some of our darkest chapters. But it isn't just that, how fortunate we have been as a nation, that we had an Abraham Lincoln or a Harry Truman or a Lyndon Johnson at certain points to confront some of these really dark and difficult issues, but that also there is something about our nation itself that has made this possible, and that another nation might not have had the wherewithal collectively to, in a sense, recover from such moments mm-hmm. of deep division. What is it about our country, and in particular maybe the way in which we began and the way in which we've grown, that have allowed us to have as a nation, at least to varying degrees, this quality?
Yeah, well, you put your finger on it. We're the only nation in the world founded on an idea, not on ethnicity, not on race, not on religion, but on the idea that fair play, we're born equal, we should have the right to rise as far as our merits and talent can take us. And anyone coming from anywhere who assents to that idea and joins the covenant that the best way to guarantee fair play for yourself is to guarantee it for other people, that's the animating American principle. We have not lived up to it at every moment, to say the least, but by and large, we've done well enough that our immigration issue is that people want to come here, not that they want to leave. And I think that we have to keep in mind, what is it about the United States that makes us different, that makes us a place where you and I, I'm sure, and most of the people we know would do anything to defend it and preserve it. And that is a devotion to fair play. And the sense that if you have the ability, if you have the ambition, you should be able to do as well as your talents can take you.
One thing I appreciated from the book's introduction, because I think most people are thinking most about some of the rather dramatic things and insightful things you have to say about some of our past presidents in contrast to our current president, but this is a book not only about that, but about others who have helped make a difference at these crucial points in our history. You say at one point in the introduction, we are a better nation because of reformers, known and unknown, celebrated and obscure, who have risked and given their lives in the conviction that, as Martin Luther King said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. How do we sort of combine those two ideas, on the one hand, of of the significance of a president leading us, and on the other hand, the work of reformers and workers for a good cause, many of whom are completely unknown to the nation as a whole.
Well, this is the nature of a free republic. It requires both. It requires the broad populace moving in the right direction. It requires the leaders who emerge from that populace to abet, not exacerbate that unfolding story. A republic is only as good as the sum of its parts. Our dispositions of heart and mind individually have a collective effect. Might not have one in an autocracy because power is in the hands of a few, and order is maintained in an autocracy by force and the threat of force. In a republic, authority is maintained morally. We take part in a society of liberty under law and the rule of law, and we give up certain rights in order to enjoy the broader freedoms. And so there is this mysterious interplay between the people who have power and the people who can only bear witness to the powerful. And at every point, whether it's been emancipation or women's suffrage or civil rights or the broad forces of American liberty, that interplay has taken place.
Mm. A last quick question. So your book is built on the premise that, in a sense, we have been here before, that for all the difficulties that we are facing, this is not an entirely new chapter. This is yet another chapter, and we have visited mm-hmm. these issues before. But so much feels so different about the world in which we now live, and it's changed at such a bewildering pace. But do you remain steadfast in that conviction that this is not a new kind of division that we are seeing? It is just sort of the latest iteration of divisions that we have suffered through before.
I really do. God willing, there's not large-scale violence in the streets. There is not violence against civil rights workers. There's not Woodrow Wilson, when he was president, launched warrantless raids on dissident homes. Again, none of this is to say, therefore, let's just not worry about what the administration is doing. But it is to argue that we need a sense of proportion. And if we surrender hope, if we say it has never been like this before because of Twitter, because of the internet, because of cable news, we're never going to get out of it, then that's totally despairing, defeating, dispiriting, and I'm not sure where it leaves us, actually. If you believe the experiment, do people really believe that the American experiment in liberty is going to die in this presidential term? I just don't. And I'm not saying it couldn't, because anything can happen at any time. That's the nature of history. It's a fallen world. But I want us to engage with the past in order to arm ourselves to make sure the experiment endures, no matter what the White House does, no matter what Congress does, no matter what happens. Hmm.
Best-selling author John Meacham. His book is titled The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. The occasion of our conversation was his visit to Carthage College last spring to serve as Carthage's commencement speaker. Tomorrow on the morning show, a couple of different interviews. One, a conversation about an upcoming performance of Shakespeare's Titus Andromachus. Also, we'll be previewing this weekend's Secret Garden Walk in Kenosha. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at our website, WGTD.org. And you can subscribe to the Morning Show podcast, which brings you a different morning show 7 days a week. You can look at Spotify, Google Podcast, or Apple Podcast, and look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show.